Welcome back to the second hour of 2 hours of Jewish Soul Music. This is your host, Charlie Bernhout. I know the vast majority of my listeners are listening to the program regularly over the archives. I'm sorry that I had a technical problem. For those regulars who tune in live on Monday evenings from 9 to 11, there was a technical problem, and I know that you are listening to this archive edition. So please accept my apologies. I know some of you who have not been listening to the first hour, I want you to be aware that the programs for the next 2 weeks have been pre-recorded. Actually, the 30th, next week, show number 103, will be a rebroadcast from a 1991 two-hour special where I went through the Friday evening Kabbalah Shabbos and Maariv davening. Then the following week, which is on June 6th, I'll still be in Israel. That will be a special two-hour, special that was first broadcast 19 years ago in 1992. And it was a two-hour Musaf, Shabbos Musaf davening that takes you through the entire davening. Those of you who love Chazonis, I'm sure will really enjoy those two programs. And God be willing, I'll be back the following Monday to share a lot of interesting facts about my trip in Israel. I did mention that aside from going to Judea and Samaria and visiting a lot of friends and so forth, I'm very excited about the fact that we'll be going to see Aida on Masada. Of course, we'll be in Israel for Yom Yerushalayim. And that was part of the theme for this special program, playing Chazonis. I'll be playing Yerushalayim Yircha, of course. I mean, what better selection could there be? First, a couple of program notes. Last night, I went with my friend Mickey Weinberger to Temple Hillel in North Woodmere, and it was a very fine concert, a Lag B'Omer cantoral concert that featured Yaakov Motzen, Moshe Shulhoff, and cantor David Guber from Netanya. And it was great to see so many old friends and lovers of Chazonis, we just have to have more of these wonderful events. What else? The cantorial concert at Congregation Beth Shalom is set for June 15th at 7:45. It will feature cantors Yitzhak Meir Helfgott, Benjamin Muller from Antwerp. There'll be an appearance by Chaim David Burson, who is at the Jewish Center. And of course, the Chazan of the Temple, who is a dear friend, cantor Joel Kaplan, will be there. Will be joining in together with the Jesse Aronson Beth Shalom Choir. They're homegrown and really very, very fine. They enjoy it, and it's a lot of fun to see them singing. Of course, Dan Eagledar will be the accompanist, as he was last night. And you always know when Danny's involved, it's always extra special. Okay, those are the program notes. So let's get right to Chazonis. And later on, I will be playing a recording of an interview I had just a few hours ago with Rabbi Stephen Przanski of B'nai Yeshurun in Teaneck, New Jersey. But let's get to our first rendition of Yerushalayim Yircha, and it'll be the great Moshe Kusevitzky.
Yerushalayim Yircha Tiri Yerushalayim Yircha, berachamim, berachamim
Moshe Koussevitzky with Vili Rushalayim Yercha. I hope you find it interesting, as I do, to hear different versions of the same selection. it's always interesting that the same composition is often interpreted so differently. And of course, when there's a different, totally different melody for composition for the same prayer, it is also it's interesting. Yes, okay. Let's hear the great Itzhomir Helfgott with his rendition, his version of V'li Rishlaim Ircha.
Yerushalayim Yerucho Berachamim 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 Yerushalayim ircho, vel Yerushalayim ircho, berachamim, berachamim, berachamim toshu. Yerushalayim ircho, berachamim, berachamim, berachamim. Koim besoicho, kasher dibarto, vesish koim besoicho, kasher dibarto, kasher. Asher dibarto, uvene oiso bekoroi meyome. Yeah. Vechisei David meira meira. Vechisei David meira meira. Leso. Vechisei David meheiro, Vechisei David meheiro, Vechisei David meheiro, meheiro, meheiro.
Itchamir Helfgott with Vili Rishalayim Ircha. We'll next hear Yossi Malavani with, again, Vili Rishalayim Ircha. Perhaps a little different version. No, that's not it. This is it. Coming right up. Here it is.
Bye.
Bella famiglia.
Yossi Malavani, our dear friend Yossi Malavani. I'm very pleased to have with me Rabbi Przanski of B'nai Yeshurun of Teaneck, New Jersey. He's currently on his way down to the AIPAC convention, and we're certainly going to hear some interesting comments about the current situation. Good evening, Rabbi.
Good evening, Charlie. How are you?
Okay, welcome back from Haaretz.
Thank you.
So, a lot happening.
Yes, it's always an interesting time, and I think a lot of the problems or the controversies that have arisen recently are self-inflicted. I think much of it comes from Obama's naivete and inexperience, because he clearly ventured far afield from his speech on Thursday that dealt primarily with the uprisings in the Arab world in which Israel is uninvolved, and then segued in a very clumsy, heavy-handed way and tried to make new policy in the Middle East that he's since walked back from, but he did it in a way that exacerbated the situation. So that really is a sign of inexperience. I trust it's not anything more malevolent.
You didn't think it was done with intent?
Well, I think it was done intentionally. I think clearly he has no recognition or appreciation of Israel's narrative, of the story of the Jewish people returning to the land that God gave us after 2,000 years of exile, all prophesied in the Bible. Clearly, his 20 years spent as a disciple of the Reverend Wright, they never got to that part of the Bible, apparently. So that drasha Reverend Wright never gave on a regular basis. So he has a very narrow view of Israel as just another colonial power that is oppressing a minority people without even understanding that that people that whose rights are he's defending does not really exist. I mean, the Palestinians are fabricated people, a late 20th century fabrication, not even early 20th century. But because it fits into an anti-colonial narrative that has guided his entire life, so therefore he sees Israel as just another oppressor. And therefore, to speak of a return to the 1967 borders, even with land swaps, it's a troubling expression of a new policy. Of course, it's a recognition that he deems inadmissible the fact that Israel acquired those territories in a defensive war. They were attacked by Arab nations and defended themselves. Such a notion of the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force, which of course is one of the principles in Resolution 242 from 1967, is only applied to Israel. It's not applied to any other nation in the world, including the United States of America, who acquired numerous territories by force over its history. So like this and many other areas, new law, new international law is created that essentially is carved out just to target the state of Israel. This you find, by the way, these days, in one of the many activities with which the Israel's foreign ministry is burdened. I spent a week last week in seminars at the foreign ministry in Yerushalayim, and it's surprising how much time has to be spent on defending Israel before various courts of international law. In fact, for example, Israel is now publicizing its flotilla defense, legal defense, because another flotilla from Turkey is anticipated in a few weeks. So not only do they have to try new military tactics, but they have to try out new legal strategies as well, as if the notion that Israel has no right to preclude an enemy from acquiring weapons with which it's going to attack Israel's civilian population is unacceptable. That doesn't make any sense. But Israel finds itself in a position where it has to defend its right to exist, defend its right to its homeland, and defend its right to self-defense. That, of course, is more than a paradox. That is a very overt expression of international Jew hatred. That is the double standard that Nathan Sharansky speaks about very often today. Israel is judged in a way that others are not. Well, President Obama is falling into the same trap, or perhaps he has dug that same trap for himself. The standards that apply to others do not apply to Israel. What struck me, by the way, about his speech on Thursday is that he was tougher on Israel than he was on Bashar al-Assad of Syria. And he was more certain that Israel has to surrender land than he is that Assad has to leave office. Assad, he gave a choice. He could stay in power or he could not stay in power. He could make choices one way or the other. But Israel, he was absolutely certain, has to surrender its biblical heartland in order to create a 22nd Arab state. That is naivete, perhaps even worse.
Well, it's not just an Arab state. It will be an Arab terrorist state. And this is the thing that boggles my mind. There cannot be any thinking person who doesn't believe that it will either be Hamas or Hezbollah or Fatah. I don't care what the organization is. They're all dedicated to the destruction of the state of Israel. And why this it just seems to get swept? Oh, they have to have their land. Well, yes, it's going to be a terrorist state. And by the way, the terror isn't just against Israel. It's against America. We are the big Satan, and Israel's the little Satan. Why doesn't the world understand this?
I don't think the world cares. I think the world generally finds Israel to be a nuisance. And in a world where nationalisms and religions amongst elite society take a lesser and lesser role, the fact that Israel is both a Jewish religious and Jewish nationalist state gives it a double whammy. Look, the ministry took us to Sderot last week, where I've been many times, and the Sderot Media Center put together a video, real time, of the 15 seconds from the time the warning goes off, Tzeva Adom, Tzeva Adom,
right.
The 15 seconds that every resident of Sderot has to find cover to avoid being pummeled by the rockets coming from Gaza, and you see the heartbreaking children screaming, Ima, Ima, Mommy, Mommy, worried, panicked, terrified.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And it was Obama himself who, on a visit to Israel when he was in campaign mode in 2008, in response to a question, said, well, if my daughters were coming under rocket attack every night, I would certainly do whatever I could to stop it.
Right.
Well, he seems to have abandoned that very premise.
Hmm.
It could be he was not sincere when he said it in 2008. But whatever it is, the elementary human dimension still remains. Why must Israel be the only country in the world whose citizens have to endure relentless rocket attacks, and any attempt to defend themselves by targeting the enemy are thwarted preemptorily? They're not allowed. because the enemy hides its rockets in civilian populations. Well, you can't let the enemy use civilians as shields. Those civilians have to get out if they're afraid, or they bear the consequences of a response or a preemption. But we would have no, there's no other situation in the world, no other country that would allow such an environment to take place. One of the legal advisors in the foreign ministry told us last week that he hosted a group of eminent international jurists who have no sympathy at all for Israel, and he asked one of them, well, if rockets were falling on your population, your civilians, emanating from an area where the enemy hid its weapons among civilians, how would you respond? What would you recommend to your government to do? And he said they sat there for 3 minutes in complete silence until the head of the group said, that's an a-contextual question. Textual, that there's no context for it. Which the legal advisor from the foreign ministry said, explain to me in what context you're prepared to answer the question. That's the reality of Israeli life, to which the world just does not care.
Right.
Rockets fall on civilians. We sat in a playground in Israel, in Sderot, which is indoor with a steel and cement reinforced roof.
Sure.
Sderot is the only place in the world where the children are not allowed anymore to play outside, because in a playground, there is not the 15 seconds that they have if a child's on the monkey bars, for example. A four-year-old child, it would take more than 15 seconds to get those children down to the monkey bars and into a shelter. They can only play indoors. But why do the Jewish people have to endure that?
I'm sorry?
The answer is that we don't have to endure that.
No.
And therefore, Israel needs our defense. They need our assistance in getting the message out. And in fact, I tell all your liberal Jewish listeners who are Obama supporters to remind Obama of what he said in 2008, that this is unacceptable, that he wouldn't accept it. So why is he asking now Israel to accept not only rockets on Sderot, but as his peace plan is put into effect, rockets on Kfar Saba and Ra'anana and Netanya and even Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim,
right,
and Ben Gurion Airport? Why do Jews have to live like that? Why does he expect us to be an inferior nation?
Well, as soon as the rockets start falling and Israel responds, Israel will be accused of being the aggressor. And this is just a never-ending cycle.
Exactly. That's why it was gratifying to hear the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, whose address I'll hear shortly, who perpetrates what they're calling the smackdown in the Oval Office. A little dose of reality for the president, that he should shed his illusions about Middle East diplomacy and the possibilities of peace, and shed his illusions as well that Israel and the Jewish people are a country and a nation that only garners disrespect and contempt from the elite policymakers. We are an eternal people. We're people chosen by God to bring goodness and morality and his ideas to the world. We're not a people that's going to be disrespected by an inexperienced, immature president, and the price to be paid for his ineptness will be dead Jews. That price we're not willing to pay. So it was good to see the Prime Minister lecture him, as others have not been before, rather than turn that meeting into a very pleasant and farcical photo op. It's time for reality. It's not a question of will he get Jewish votes or not, or will his poll numbers rise or fall. It's a question of Jewish life and the survival of the Jewish state. That was the message that Netanyahu sent to Obama. Did he receive it? I doubt it. But nonetheless, he heard it, and therefore he realized, as I hope remains true in the future, Israel can also say the word no. No is also in his diplomatic lexicon. If policies that are proffered by either Obama or the Europeans or anyone endanger Israel's existence, he has a right to say no and an obligation to posterity to say no.
Well, the whole idea of a demilitarized Palestinian state could never be. First of all, once a state is a state, it has the right to arm itself. So that concept doesn't make any sense. It's just words.
It would control its own borders, control its airspace. It would be considered a denigration of its sovereignty to have these encroachments enshrined in agreements. And that's not to say they heed their agreements anyway. The fact is, it shocked me even last week to read, when I was in Israel, one of the papers had a headline that Obama is going to call for the Arabs to accept Israel's right to exist and to renounce terror. Well, didn't we do this 10 times before? Didn't Israel make tangible concessions in 1994, in 96, in 97, in 99, in 2000, et cetera, in exchange for the same two promises? So for how long are they going to try to sell that same rug? Do they think we're fools? You know, there's an expression, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Fool me 10 times, we must be idiots. We must have no sense at all. So, of course, those promises are meaningless, and they should not be accepted in exchange for any concession at all, even not in exchange for negotiation. The price for those stale and breached promises have been 2,000 Israelis dead, over 10,000 wounded, and more than 10,000 evicted from their homes. That price is not going to be paid anymore.
Well, why would anyone believe any agreement written by an Arab Muslim group or country when we know that the moment they just want to ignore it, it's just a piece of paper? Why trade land for a piece of paper that is meaningless?
It's a very good question, revised by a statement made by Amram Musa about 6 weeks ago. Musa was the former foreign minister of Egypt and head of the Arab League, who was dismissed from his post as foreign minister by Mubarak because he was too filled with hatred of Israel. Musa's running now for president of Egypt. And he said about 6 weeks ago that the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty is irrelevant today and has to be renegotiated, which of course provokes the question, what has to be renegotiated? They signed a peace treaty in 1979. Apparently there's been peace between the parties for over 30 years. What could they possibly renegotiate? Except for the fact they're looking to walk back recognition, the commitment by Egypt to sell oil and natural gas to Israel at a fixed market price, and to also renounce or renege on Israel's commitment not to remilitarize the Sinai Peninsula. Well, if any Arab reserves the right to sign an agreement and then unilaterally, willy-nilly, pronounce it irrelevant 10, 20, 30 years later, so then they are not trustworthy interlocutors in diplomacy, and the Israelis have to keep that in mind as well. Contracts, agreements, peace treaties, therefore mean nothing.
I'm planning on my program to regularly point out two minor facts that occurred in 1964. I lived in Israel in 1964 prior to the... the 1967 war, where we reacquired the old city. I remember standing by barbed wire in Jerusalem, looking out at the old city, and there were Jordanian guards, and I was told not to stand too close to that barbed wire, or they would shoot at me. Now, of course, that's 67 is 33, 44 years ago. I mean, most people don't even remember or not even cognizant of the fact that from 1948 to 67, no Jew was allowed to go to the old city, to the Kotel. Today, we just take it as a given. But if, God forbid, you know, in any so-called agreement that Jerusalem and the Old City comes under the control of the enemy, you can kiss that goodbye, what we take for granted today. And of course, in 1964, that was the year that Arafat formed the PLO. When they had Judea Samaria, they had half of Jerusalem, they had Gaza, the Golan, they had all that. So what was what were they liberating? What was the Palestine Liberation Organization formed to liberate when they already had everything that at that time other than Israel proper, if you will? Of course, it was the destruction of the state of Israel. And why do people not even recognize that?
That, Charlie, is a critical point. I was but a small child in 1964. But that date is critical because it was the date in which the PLO was founded, long before settlements became an issue, long before there was a sanctity made of the 1967 borders. The fact is, the Palestine Liberation Organization was created not to liberate Judea Samaria, but in order to liberate Palestine, Israel, to destroy Israel. In fact, one of the things that people fail to account for, that you alluded to, is that had there been a Palestinian people with a national aspiration, there was no reason why a Palestinian state could not have been created in 47 or 48, or in fact, from 1948 to 67, when those lands were controlled by Arabs, Jordan and Egypt respectively. But there was never even a thought to make a Palestinian state because there was no such people. The people, so to speak, are just a club by which they hope to beat Israel into submission. But I will tell you something frightening. I raised this very point with one of the left wingers in the foreign ministry last week, that the PLO was created before 1967, when settlements were not an issue. And in fact, they do not answer the question. There's a disconnect that you find when certain facts do not fit in with a conception, philosophical or political, of events, of reality. They're just ignored. And that said, it happens not infrequently on the left. One person, one bureaucrat in the ministry said last week about the necessity of a new state solution. Israel can't survive without it. And when he was asked by one of my rabbinical colleagues on the trip, well, what about the withdrawal from Gaza and the rockets on Sderot and Ashkelon? Not only did he have an answer for that, he did not even address the question. Because this didn't take place. Because to admit that it did take place and then to factor it into your policy conclusions and analyses means that you have to come up with a different conclusion, and therefore they simply disregard it. That is not uncommon, but it is frightening.
Yes.
Because then you're dealing with individuals who are attempting to make policy or articulate Israel's policy, and certain crucial dimensions of the conflict are not within their worldview. Whether it is the PLO in 1964 being founded, whether it is rockets on Sderot that were a result of the last withdrawal, whether it was the terror that emanated from parts of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza after 1994 and 95, when Israel withdrew its forces from those territories and created an Area A all under exclusive Palestinian jurisdiction. They don't take facts into account. And when you don't take facts into account, whether you're a doctor or a lawyer or a political analyst, either your patient or your client or your people will suffer very unfortunate consequences, respectively.
Rabbi, it's interesting. A lot of people, and it's amazing, are not aware that there's about 1.2 million Arabs who live in Israel as citizens who vote, who have members of Knesset, the member on the Supreme Court. And when they talk of an Arab, God forbid, a Palestinian state, and they clearly state that no Jew, or I guess we're Christian, but no Jew would ever be allowed to live in a Palestinian state. It's all right for them to have a Judenrein country, but Israel, which is living with these Arab enemies, and they are enemies, or potential enemies, let's say, right within its borders, they are accused of being an apartheid state. And the hatred that Jews themselves, when they talk about Israel is just an apartheid state, and look at what we do to the poor Arabs, and it makes no sense. I mean, it infuriates me, to say the least.
Well, Charlie, that's part of the, sad to say, racial and racist dimension of Islamic life. It's not only hostility directed against Jews, although we're the primary targets being a national entity, but it's directed against the Copts, the Christian Copts in Egypt, who are under the gun now for years, against the Christians in Lebanon, who suffer to the extent their population has declined, the Christians of Beit Lechem, of Bethlehem. That was a historically Christian Arab city where Christians are now less than 10% of the population because they've been forced to flee. You're right. They want the Judea Samaria, the land of their so-called future state, to be Unrein without any Jews at all as a prelude to making the Middle East free of any Jew or Christian residents except as second-class citizens. Well, the Israeli Arabs, one of the ministers pointed out last week, live with a cognitive dissonance because they want to be Israeli citizens. If a Palestinian state, an Arab state, is created in Judea Samaria, no Israeli Arab will go live there because they recognize the blessings living in a free democratic state. They won't live there. On the other hand, they want such a state to be created in order to help them deal with the discomfort caused by the fact that they love it. They want the Israeli identity so much. Not understanding that it's the creation of that Palestinian state that will not only endanger the state of Israel as it exists, but will impair their lives as well. Because when Israel becomes indefensible, their lives also become indefensible. And we recall in 2006, the war in Lebanon, when Hezbollah randomly fired its 10,000 rockets into northern Israel, there were dozens of Arab-Israeli casualties as well. Because again, those rockets were misguided, and they landed randomly, and Arabs were killed as well. Some of those Arabs, because of the nature of the identity, had to blame Israel for those Arab rockets falling on their heads. But the more sane among them recognized who the true enemy was, the enemy coming from the north, those who hate Israel. So I wouldn't say that all Israeli Arabs are anti-Israel. I would say that a good majority of them live with that cognitive dissonance in which they hope for a Palestinian state to address their own insecurities about their identity, although they would never think of living there. Like too much the benefits and blessings of the Jewish state in which they live, in which they have full rights, as we know, in which they have an Arab serving Knesset, in which there's an Arab member of the Supreme Court, something that would be impossible to exist in any of the Arab lands that we're talking about now.
Well, Rabbi, I know you're on your way to the AIPAC convention to hear Netanyahu, and I pray that I trust that it will be worthwhile, and I look forward to more conversations with you. Unfortunately, I'm leaving for Israel on Sunday, so the next week or two, my programs are set. But when I come back, I certainly want to continue this conversation because I always trust and admire your words and look forward to having them shared with my listeners.
Charlie, I hope the Prime Minister gives a very strong, very powerful, very passionate speech filled with Jewish pride. He'll find a ready audience to respond to it, and with that, we'll be able to assist in Israel's defense in the future. Thanks for having me. Have a very safe and enjoyable trip.
Thank you, Rabbi. And again, thank you for taking the time to share these thoughts with us.
Pleasure.
Shalom.
Well, that was a very interesting conversation with Rabbi Stephen Przanski of Congregation B'nai Yeshurun in Teaneck, New Jersey. Time for one more selection on Yerushalayim. Jerusalem Day is June 1st. This is the great Moshe Stern with Yerushalayim Hashlema.
L'chaim, l'chaim, Yerushalayim, l'chaim, l'chaim, Yerushalayim, l'chaim, l'chaim, Yerushalayim, l'chaim, l'chaim, Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim Hashleima, Yerushalayim Hashleima, Yerushalayim Hashleima, Yerushalayim Hashleima. Im lo akshav, im atay. Im lo akshav, im lo akshav, im lo akshav, im Lechaim, 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 Yerushalayim, lechaim, lechaim, Yerushalayim, lechaim, lechaim, Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim Hashleima, Yerushalayim Hashleima, Yerushalayim Hashleima, Yerushalayim Hashleima, Hashleima, Hashleima.
Well, it's a certainly appropriate way to end this program. I'm on my way to Yerushalayim this coming Sunday. As I mentioned, on Monday, the 30th, you'll be hearing a two-hour special that was recorded first in 1991, 20 years ago, a Kabbalah Shabbos and Maariv of Davening. And then the following week, June 6th, you'll be hearing a rebroadcast from a 1992 two-hour special, which was a Shabbos Musaf davening. I expect to have a lot to discuss with you on my way back, or when I come back, God be willing, on the 13th. In the meantime, it's always good to hear from you. You know you can reach me at cbjmusic@aol.com. That's CB as in boy, or Charlie Bernhout, cbjmusic@aol.com. And again, I am so sorry about the technical problem. For those of you who are tuning in live on Monday evening, that's showbiz. What can I tell you? I will certainly get to the bottom of it, and I hope that doesn't happen again. So shalom, everyone. Again, thanks for joining with me.